This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. A big college fair is coming to the Convention Center, the National Association of College Admissions Counselors, and this is where you can go shop for colleges. Mark Hoffer is a certified college advisor at Your College Matters. So how does this work? I mean, I've been to college fairs before, back when the kids were auditioning. Who do they send out to these colleges? Are these actual admissions people, the people who make the decisions?
Absolutely, yeah. They're admissions representatives from the different colleges all over the country that come to Seattle, and they basically talk to kids and tell them about their schools and why they have an incredible environment for learning.
Right. So it's, you get the sales pitch, huh?
You do.
Now, is that a place where you can do your own pitch? Are they looking for that, or are they just going to hand that information to you?
No, they actually talk to the representatives, and there are also counselors in the Seattle area that are talking about different things, different aspects. Like on Friday and Saturday, I'm talking about STEM education and how students can prepare for that. So students and parents can hear that information that deals with the college admissions process. And then they talk also with the admissions representatives.
There's been a huge change since I applied to college, and even since my kids applied to college. I mean, everything is online now, isn't it?
It is. Almost everything. There are some scholarships that require you to mail them in still with snail mail, but most of the application process is done definitely through the internet and online. Interviews, however, a lot of schools are still giving interviews in person.
Okay, so you have to decide when you're going in what kind of college you're going for, right? I mean, am I going to go for one of the elites like Harvard, Yale, Columbia, or am I going to go for football school? I mean, what categories, how would you categorize the various college options these days?
You can categorize them on their level of admissions percentages. There are ultra elite colleges,
right,
which have
really selective ones. Yeah.
Exactly. Less than 5%.
Less than 5%. That's what Harvard does.
Harvard's
less than 5%. And you have to have a relative with his name on a building, I believe, right?
It doesn't hurt. Yeah. College, Stanford and Harvard are actually less than 5% admissions now.
Yeah. So in other words, there are some kids who need not apply. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, they're going to need to have the SAT and GPA that allow them that first step in and basically open the doors.
What level is that at these days? What score do you need?
It depends on the school. The lower the percentage, the higher the SAT.
Right. So give me a ballpark. I mean, if you're aiming at Harvard, what kind of SAT do you have to have?
Yes, you're going to need 1,500 and 3.9 or better.
Yeah.
That's to get looked at.
Yeah. All right. So if you're below that, who are you looking at then?
That's actually where the real science or the art of identifying the schools. Schools have a 50% band that they publish every year, and it's basically 50% of the students that they admitted last year. That SAT and GPA band, you know that if you have your GPA and SAT are within that band, you have a good shot of getting into that school. But if your scores and your metrics are lower than that, you're going to have a hard time getting in.
Okay, so that's the first winnowing then. It still then comes down to your SATs, huh?
I thought
colleges were getting away from that.
They are. Matter of fact, the University of Chicago is one of the first really elite schools that said, you know, we are stepping away from the SAT as part of our admissions criteria. And I think there are going to be a lot more schools who are going to follow that.
Okay, so if for schools that don't use the SAT.
Yep.
Let's look at that because we know the rules of the SAT. So that's pretty clear. You got a band and either you're in it or you're not. All right. So for colleges that are de-emphasizing it, then how do you stand out?
Exactly. And that's where I think the more holistic admissions process comes into play, and schools are looking at those things that they have found really indicate a student who's going to be successful over time at their school. They're going to graduate on time and they're going to graduate successfully. And those indicators, they're finding out things like, do students build a support system naturally as high school students? Because that's going to carry
over. What does that mean?
Basically, who are the people that you lean on when things get tough? Do you have a set of people around you that you lean on when things get difficult, and they will in college?
Yeah.
Do you do that naturally? Have you done that in high school? And can you show that in your application?
Wow. So they're looking for people who are not going to need a lot of counseling when things get tough.
Well, that's not only the issue that colleges know. We've got over 60% of students as freshmen and sophomores that are identifying that they are, by all intents and purposes, clinically depressed.
Wow.
And the schools know that has a incredible.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's why. So that's what. That's the thing here. They have so many kids who are clinically depressed. They want them to come with a support system already in place.
Or know how to build one. They naturally develop that. The reason why is the other staggering statistic is 80% of students they have high anxiety in that it's messing with their ability to attend.
Shouldn't we be finding out why that's happening?
Agreed. It is a big part of it.
Is it because of the whole admissions process itself, maybe, or just because people are in such, dicey family situations? What is it?
Students are stressed out, and you mentioned it. The situation for applying to college has changed dramatically in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of teens, and they're stressed, and they're carrying that into college. And yes, I totally agree with you. We should examine why are they so stressed out when they're heading.
So is it self-imposed? Is it because parents are making? I certainly hear in our school district from the teachers that you have parents who say, "Look, my kid's going to Harvard. Mm-hmm. You will give him an A." That kind of thing, which obviously trickles down to the student too.
Sure. I mean, students, we have very smart kids, and they're aware of the pressures that are on them. And they're trying to hit all these targets that they're hearing from parents and from society, and that if you don't go into one of these elite colleges, you failed. And that's a pressure cooker.
Well, Val, you're the expert on that. Is it not true that having a Harvard degree is a ticket to great riches? Heck, in Bill Gates' case, even almost having a Harvard degree is a ticket to great riches. So, I mean, if it's true, you just have to deal with that, don't you?
Well, no. The statistics actually show that your undergraduate school is not necessarily an indicator of future success. And that's one of the myths. And students are often not aware of this. If you go to a good undergraduate school, finding one that meets your mission and your professional and academic mission and social mission, you'll be more successful, get better grades, and then you apply to a good graduate school. And that matters.
So for late bloomers, don't focus on Harvard. Focus on the school that will get you to Harvard.
Exactly. Yeah. Get good grades, have a good college education, and learn all the social skills that you'll need to get into graduate school.
See, that would take a lot of the stress off, just knowing that. And do are students surprised when you tell them that?
Oh, absolutely, because they've been fed this myth and this story that it's all about these top 25 schools.
The college fair is at the Washington State Convention Center. Mark Hoffer is a certified college advisor from Your College Matters. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
6:47 Seattle's Morning News. The early ballot returns here in Washington are pretty close to what we saw at this point in the 2016 election, so that's pretty good. Republicans are counting on better turnout from their base than the primary, as they try to hold on to several seats Democrats have been targeting. That includes a state House seat in Snohomish County's 44th District. Hannah Scott is here to tell us about that. Hannah.
This one is two-term Republican Representative Mark Harmsworth, who was surprised when the initial primary results came in and had him about 10 points down to his Democratic challenger, Jarrett Mead. Harmsworth closed that gap to down around 7 points when all of the votes were in and has been fighting back to hold his seat. His opponent, Jarrett Mead, has been a Mill Creek City Councilman for about a year and would be the youngest person in the legislature should he win at 27 years old. And though he admits he did a bit better in the primary than he expected, he's felt that he could win since the start and he is confident heading into Election Day. On the issues for the district, a top priority, which the district includes Lake Stevens, Snohomish, Mill Creek, and parts of Marysville, so transportation is a really big deal there, especially the Highway 2 trestle and possible tolls, which Harmsworth has promised to fight as a central part of his campaign. But Mead insists the looming threat of tolling the trestle is a scare tactic by Harmsworth based on parts of a study he took out of context and made public.
Intentionally, it turns out, because now he's got stickers all over his signs that say hashtag no trestle toll, and he's got ads in the newspaper, and he's got a big following on Facebook, and he gets the campaign on hashtag no trestle toll, a lie he made up. None of the people that are making these decisions are talking about tolls on the trestle. He's talking about tolls on the trestle. The only person I hear talking about it is a constituency scared and him.
But Harmsworth insists tolling on the trestle is absolutely a real threat.
State Senator Steve Hobbs has already admitted that he's looking at potential up to two lanes in each direction for tolling. So for my opponent to say that it's all made up, it's pretty disingenuous. I mean, there's physical evidence this is going to happen.
Now, Harmsworth paints Meade as a toll supporter, but Meade says that's misleading.
I would never be in favor of tolling even any of the current lanes we have. Now, in the future, when they add lanes, that was what was in the study, was potentially tolling any new lanes added to the trestle. That's not necessarily something I'm in favor of, but it's also not something that I would hashtag and absolutely say no to and blow up before we even sat at the table, before we even sat at the table with the leaders in the region to discuss what our options are. That's the big difference between Mark and I.
Now, Harmsworth would also continue his effort to stop the 405 tolls if he's reelected. On car tab relief, another big issue in this part of the state, Harmsworth has said he has already dropped bills for a more fair valuation system and to even get rid of car tab hikes altogether that came with SD3 and have Sound Transit come back to the legislature and start all over again.
I want to see Sound Transit come back and explain what they're doing to the legislature. I believe if you put Sound Transit 3 back on the ballot right now, it wouldn't pass.
Meade actually agrees it's unlikely SD3 would pass now, and he believes Sound Transit did dupe voters. He supports looking into some type of car tab relief, but he also wants to see the project make it to the district, so he's not sure how to get that car tab relief yet. What Meade is sure of is that he wants the Sound Transit Board to be elected rather than appointed.
We need a board that's directly accountable to us so that if we think that they're not doing well or we disagree with some of the policies or an initiative they put on the ballot or how they're spending that money, we can boot them and get somebody else in there.
Harmsworth also wants the board elected. As for easing congestion, Harmsworth says autonomous vehicle carpools are going to be the better option than trains in the long run. And he's on a task force in the legislature to look into those. He has a background in tech. He used to work for Microsoft. On education, Meade wants to help fund capital projects to address overcrowding in schools by lowering the threshold to pass school construction bonds to a simple majority, 50-55%. He's also open to some tweaks to the levy cap that came with McCleary to help districts in need. Harmsworth is a hard no on messing with McCleary. Both want to get more money for special needs kids. Harmsworth says he's got a record of working across the aisle and backing constituents over party, like being one of a very few to vote against a bill exempting lawmakers from the Public Records Act and the bipartisan bill he co-sponsored to protect biometric data. But Meade paints him as being out of touch with his constituents and taking a radical party line for voting against bills like a conversion therapy ban. Meade says he's an independent thinker who will do what's best for his district and avoid getting sucked into any super liberal Seattle agendas. But Harmsworth doesn't buy it.
He's a fine man, but he doesn't have the experience he needs to really understand the constituent in this district. And, it's admirable he's done what he's done, but he's just not ready.
So do both of them want, I hear us talk about Sound Transit. Do they want the station up there in Snohomish County or not?
Mark Harmsworth wants it to stop in Northgate. Jared Meade wants transit up in the district.
Okay, so Harmsworth just wants it to stop in Northgate and not go to Snohomish County.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. That's, well,
yeah,
that's
he wants them. He wants
then.
It to come up for a vote again, which he thinks would not happen. It would fail if it went to voters again at this point. And he wants Sound Transit to come to the legislature and explain itself.
And again, on the trestle, Meade, the young challenger, he says he's against tolling the existing trestle.
Yeah, the lanes are there. Against, yeah, yeah.
But if they were to expand it and add additional lanes,
yes, then it would be one of the options he would consider.
One of the options,
which is what they are planning.
Yeah.
They're planning on building an entirely new trestle.
So a
and
parallel
tolling
trestle.
It likely, yeah. Tolling it is on the table as one of the options to pay for that new trestle. They would likely toll the existing trestle in advance to help offset some
as they did with 520?
Exactly. Yeah. Potentially. So it is definitely on the table as we've talked to people about that expansion of the Highway 2
But corridor. The alternative would be no trestle, no new trestle.
That right? would be correct.
Yeah. So if you want a new trestle.
It would be a pay to get a new system, to get a new corridor, yeah.
But we need federal money for that, too, right? I think they
both
told me that.
They're trying to get some grant money for that as well. Steve Hobbs is involved in that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Here he is, movie man Michael Medved, with not one but two musical movies being released, Bohemian Rhapsody and The Nutcracker and the Four Realms. Well, Bohemian Rhapsody, that's about Queen, correct?
Correct.
Bohemian Rhapsody, We Will Rock You, another one bites the dust. So is it a jukebox picture, a biopic? Or
It's all of the above, but it's better than you think and better than the reviews are indicating. I don't understand entirely why. It may be because people are so deeply devoted to Queen and its music, and of course this is somebody trying to perform as Freddie Mercury, and he doesn't look that much like the original Freddie Mercury.
Except he has a very convincing tooth prosthetic, I hear.
He does. And his moves are perfect. I know this film is going to be a big hit, despite the reviews, because it reminds you of how many hits and how interesting and wonderful and exciting the music of Queen really was.
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform. So what can they do? Imagine thousands of people doing this in unison. Huh? Well, what's the lyric?
The entire film is well written, it's well directed, and it's brilliantly acted. The kid who plays Freddie Mercury is named Rami Malek, and the film breaks a lot of the cliches that you expect to see about a troubled rock star. It focuses in on not drug addiction, which you kind of expect, and not self-destructive indulgence, but difficulties and challenges that he had in his life. But the normal thing that you see in biographies of big music stars about what a tragedy and how miserably it ended, it simply wasn't true with Freddie Mercury. He died of AIDS at age 45. But to say that he destroyed himself in the way that, oh, say, Michael Jackson or Prince or other very big stars did is not accurate.
Does it explain what Bohemian Rhapsody means?
No.
Song,
it,
I mean?
No, but it shows the creative process in doing it, and that he wanted Bohemian Rhapsody to be operatic.
Galileo Picaro!
How was that?
Higher.
Can you go a bit higher?
If I go any higher, only dogs will hear me.
Try. Hiya.
One of the difficulties with the film, one of the reasons that I would give it 3.5 stars and not 4, is because Freddie Mercury really is pretty much the only character that you meet in the film. The other members of the band, this one was the astrophysicist and this one was the electrical engineer. These were all very bright, educated people. This was not a one of your rock bands with working class cred, as people talk about.
What about Nutcracker, The Four Realms?
Well, this is a very different kind of musical, and I must tell you, much, much less successful. Now, I'm not saying that you should take little kids to see the Freddie Mercury movie. It's rated PG-13. But Nutcracker, Four Realms is basically an attempt to do yet again another movie version of the Nutcracker ballet. None of the previous versions of Nutcracker have worked particularly well, and I think that's because, how do you put it? I mean, going to see Nutcracker.
Happens.
Right, exactly. There's in Act Two, people are sitting around
watching.
On stage watching other people
it's about,
dance.
It's about ballet, which doesn't translate well to a movie screen.
Correct. So they change it this time. And
does the rat appear?
There's no big Mouse King. What there is, and this is ingenious, it's actually the best part of the film. Rather than having one giant mouse, they have this monster that is created by a bunch of mice coming together. They sort of form, and it's very well done. Some of these special effects are brilliant. The sets are really eye-popping and imaginative. The movie's a complete dud.
Is there dancing in it?
Yes. Misty Copeland, a great American ballet star, plays the ballerina. She doesn't say a word. And her intermittent scenes of her dancing close up, which, by the way, misses the whole point.
I mean, it's a natural thing for Disney to do because it's a very popular fairy tale. It's certainly a great brand, but as we've pointed out, there's not much of a story there unless you make one up.
Correct. And obviously, for a Disney fairy tale to work, you have to make it there being some struggle between good and evil and some threat, some jeopardy. And in the original Nutcracker, the only jeopardy is from the mice.
And so far, you haven't mentioned a nutcracker. Is there a nutcracker?
There is a nutcracker. He's a nutcracker prince, very charismatic and likable. You can watch this thing and be sort of amazed at the lavish visuals, but it doesn't add up. And if you're going to use the Tchaikovsky music, then use the damn music. Two stars for Nutcracker, The Four Realms. I think that some of the magic that you get seeing the Nutcracker on stage, it's just impossible to capture in a film version.
Two stars for Nutcracker, The Four Realms, and 3.5 for Bohemian Rhapsody. Michael Medved, thank you.
You bet. Thanks so much, Dave.
Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Ticket giveaway coming up in a few minutes. First, though, let's go to Danny O'Neill on a Blue Friday to handicap the game. We're in the same division, I just realized, as this team that's got 8 wins and 0 losses.
That's correct.
So what chance do we have, as good as the team has gotten, winning the division?
Well, I would say better than 50% chance of making the playoffs right now. Of winning the division, it's definitely under 10, maybe even under 5% at this point. It's unlikely that Seattle's going to win the division. But that doesn't mean you're not going to get to the playoffs. And that's this season for the Seahawks, I think, actually looks really good.
How many wild cards are there, then?
Two.
And we still have a mathematical chance of making
Not mathematical chance. I would say likelihood. Like right now, I think the odds are better than not. Seattle's played 5 of their 7 games on the road, and they're 4-3. And they're going to their schedule over the end of it, 4 of their final 5 games are at home, and they're going to be favored to win all but one of those games, that being the game against Kansas City. We'll see San Diego. Well, I'm sorry. It's the Los Angeles Chargers. They moved.
Whatever.
The Los Angeles Chargers come in. They've won 4 in a row. They're 5-2, so they've got a better record than Seattle, and I expect Seattle to beat them.
Why does L.A. get 2 teams?
That is a great question, Colleen, because they've shown no ability or interest to keep so much as one team, and now they've got 2 of them.
Yeah.
The Rams, the aforementioned undefeated Rams, last weekend they hosted the Packers. More Green Bay fans than Rams fans at their stadium.
Huh.
Now, they haven't moved into their new digs, the new palatial Taj Mahal of sports, which is the reason that there are 2 teams there. But still, there's been documented lack of interest on the part of Los Angeles for decades.
And yet they're a great team.
Oh, the Rams. I know.
What's the deal?
It's not LA's. You can't credit LA for making them a great team, can you?
No.
Because they just came from, what, St. Louis?
They've been there 3 years. Yeah. They got good once they got to LA. It's LA.
Oh.
It's the market.
It's the money.
There's a lot of things to do, and people are really interested. And I think it's tough to be like an actual functioning member of society when you wear flip-flops every day. You're like, whatever, dude.
Real chill.
We'll see what happens.
Are they the best team in the NFL right now, the Rams?
The Rams are, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they've got a great offense. We'll see about their defense. They give up some points. They won't go undefeated.
So
that's not going to happen.
To the Chargers, their quarterback is Philip Rivers.
He's got a very punchable face.
Which does not strike me.
I got to look it up now. You always make me do this.
It doesn't strike me as a football name.
Philip Rivers?
Yeah, Philip Rivers sounds like a Shakespearean actor. Now, Dick Butkus, that's a football name.
It sounds like a folk singer. Philip Rivers.
Yeah, Philip Rivers. He does like to wear bolo ties, which I think is absolutely annoying.
Do you want to see his face, Dave?
See if Dave Ross thinks he has a punchable face.
Good-looking guy.
Punchable? Yeah, oh yeah.
I wouldn't go near him.
You want to go sock him in his suck hole. Because the way he talks, when he just constantly talks. Bobby Wagner said it this week. Like, one time he's just talking trash, and I looked around to him. I was like, you know we can come get you. It's not like you're running fast. But yeah, he talks an awful lot.
He's got one of those pretty thick necks. I don't go around challenging guys like that.
He also has a weird throwing motion. It's like he's trying to flick something off the end of his finger.
It
like
works,
just
though.
Got something.
So,
yeah.
So how does he stack up against Russell Wilson?
Phillip Rivers is one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the league, and Russell's right there.
Yeah.
And if you gave everybody a choice between the two of them, if you said it's just for this season, I think the majority might take Phillip Rivers because he's playing really, really well. If you said it's for the long term, they'd all take Russell Wilson because he's so much younger. Phillip Rivers is a legitimate, bona fide, documented franchise quarterback. He's the best thing about the Chargers. Russell, he's a playmaker. I don't know if he's the best thing about the Seahawks. The Seahawks is we're still figuring out what their best strengths are, and maybe it's that they don't have any discernible weaknesses. It's a really well-rounded team.
How come two of our standout players were seventh round draft picks?
I know.
What's that?
Well, it's part of the genius of Philip Rivers was the fourth overall pick. He ended up getting traded for Eli Manning. Seattle, when they've been at their best, it's been able to find not just good players. If you have a seventh round player that turns out to start for you, that's a great draft pick. If you've got a seventh round pick that turns out to be a star, and there's a chance that Chris Carson is going to be that, and David Moore is right now on his way to being an impact player, it's the hugest. Those are franchise changing type drafts because teams spend years. How are the Rams so good right now? Well, they spent 10 years being one of the consistently worst teams in the league. They accumulated top 10 selection after top 10 selection. And eventually you've got so much talent, you almost can't help but win. Once you get rid of a really crappy coach like Jeff Fisher, who was basically an anvil that was dragging the whole thing down, then everyone's like, whoa, this team's good. Yeah, because they've been drafting in the top 10 for 10 years.
Is that what the Mariners need? Some 10 years of top drafting?
Colleen, I don't want to talk about them. What the Mariners need is about six sticks of dynamite shoved into every opening at the major league level and just explode it and start from scratch.
Yeah.
New team name, new team colors, and then we won't have to worry about what's wrong with the Mariners.
Just a total refresh.
4 years later, we'll come back and we'll call them the Seattle Sockeyes if the NHL team doesn't take it first.
Hey, a lot of self-care.
You haven't done any hockey terms for a while.
That's true.
We're going to do hockey terms once a week. So we get ready.
Well, are they going to be the Sockeyes?
No, I hope so.
I don't like that.
Why?
It's because I think we can be more creative.
Come on, Colleen. I want you to imagine a little cartoon fish standing on his back fins with his little flippers up 1930s boxing style, and he's got a black eye.
I'm only a fan if they let us throw Sockeyes onto the ice.
Heck yeah.
If we win.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about the Gooey Ducks? Then you only need one glove.
Yeah, that's true. The Gooey Ducks would be weird. Ooh. Yeah, you can't dig us out.
I feel like we'd be the butt of many jokes with the Gooey Ducks.
That's probably true.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by... Oh, what's your score for the game? I forgot.
Score for the game is going to be 24-17 Seahawks.
24-17.
Also, face wash.
Got it. Okay. It was 3 years ago today that Seattle and King County declared a homeless emergency. But in those 3 years, the solutions have been as elusive, and I'm guessing that nobody listening can see any difference in the homeless population as far as you're concerned. So did declaring an emergency even help? For that, we turn to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. So 3 years in?
3 years in appears to be little in the way of success, right? More people in tents on the sidewalks, a huge increase in people living in their vehicles. There's trash, needles everywhere, and even violence, with many in the homeless population dealing with untreated severe mental illness or substance abuse. Freshman Seattle City Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda says that emergency declaration only came with about $5 million. And while that did lead to more shelters opening and more services,
the crisis, though, is much bigger than we can solve with existing services. So on the street, when we drive to work, when we walk to work, when we ride the bus, we see more and more people living outside because we simply do not have the shelter and the housing to serve them. Our shelters are at capacity. There is no vacancy in our long-term permanent supportive housing. There is no place to pull people in from the streets and in from the parks and shelter them. And so we have a crisis that we have not yet met 3 years later.
In 2015, when the emergency was declared in the city and the county, they both asked the state and federal governments to step in and help, including several specific requests for assistance, but virtually nothing has come from the federal level. But the state has made some progress on some things, like passing a bill allowing public lands to be used for tent encampments or RV lots or affordable housing, and increasing recording fees for real estate documents, which King County says its share of this year will help house 800 people. The state also restored funding to a key affordable housing program for low-income people, but not enough. And another bill expanded eligibility for a rental assistance program, but lawmakers still have to put the actual funding along with that, which will be a major focus in the upcoming session. In Seattle, we've seen a lot of efforts come and go over the 3 years, but much of it came with problems and not much in the way of progress, leaving the city with a major lack of affordable housing, some tiny house villages, some increases in basic and enhanced shelter beds, but nowhere near enough. Muscata admits it's frustrating.
It's incredibly frustrating for me, for all of our colleagues here, I'm sure for the mayor and for the community at large, when we are a city that is shown repeatedly that we are compassionate about making sure kids have access to high quality education, making sure people have the services that they need. We have repeatedly stood up and shown that we're a progressive city that wants to care for the most vulnerable. And here we are in one of the most prosperous cities, and we don't yet have enough housing or shelter to care for those outside.
Now, the city has nearly doubled the money it is spending on its homeless response in the last 3 years. And Muscata was quick to jump on that law passed by the state allowing public lands to be used. She passed two ordinances this year in the council to take advantage of it. One allowing City Light to get rid of its extra land at little or no cost. And another one that requires the city to consider whether its surplus land can be used for affordable housing. And if it can, to make it available for that. And she says she's going back to the state for more.
Appreciate that a declaration was called by the city and the county 3 years ago, but we still have more folks that are falling into homelessness than we can currently serve. And I am hoping that a call for additional revenue, additional flexibility in how we build housing, the ability to get folks not just into shelter but in long-term housing is something I know our state legislature is concerned about as well. And I hope that this emergency also resonates in the halls of Olympia this year.
Did I hear you say that they're giving away city land for affordable housing?
They've passed, yeah, there was a city council passed her Muscata's ordinance this this term, and it basically says that the city needs to look at whether any of its surplus land can be used for affordable housing, and if so, make it available for that.
And nobody's taken them up on it? Or?
No, it's very recent. I think it was just last month that that was passed. So I think it's in the works.
And so as a condition of getting this land, I assume at a really reduced rate, you'd have to agree to limit the rent or something like that?
Yeah, something like it's something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Muscata says while the city has to look at getting more shelter and help for those living in vehicles, a huge part of the solution here is going to be planning ahead, something she says could have made a big difference if we had done it when the emergency declaration was originally made.
That is the biggest question that we should ask ourselves. Are there dollars that we can be investing now that will help us prevent a crisis on the horizon? If that $5 million had been invested in affordable housing in the past, would we see fewer people on the street? If we had done a better job at preventing people from getting evicted or having additional rental assistance just to get through some tough times, would we have prevented more people from falling into homelessness and into the street?
Now, as for the mayor, her plan to increase shelter capacity by 500 beds should be completed before the end of the year. And she's also looking to L.A. for a good model on how the city and county can successfully govern together to manage the crisis.
I just remember the people from the Union Gospel Mission coming to me. I guess it was last year we had them on the air. And they said, anybody who wants shelter can get it.
Oh, and
there's but you're saying now everything is at capacity.
Well, and here's the deal. The city is, first of all, very focused now on these enhanced shelters, which is different than your basic mat on the floor shelter, 24-hour shelter. They've got, right, you know, services, laundry, showers, things like that. And those are, there's only like, I think, anywhere from 4 to 12 of those kind of beds available at any given time. The other ones are all at 90% or more capacity all the time is what they're telling me every day. So,
okay. Hannah Scott, thank you. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. After something horrible like the synagogue massacre, we look for reasons, of course, and we look for someone to blame. And in the case of the massacre, some people blame President Trump for his language. Some pointed the finger at conspiracy theorists, so I thought we'd look into that. And Joe Yusinski is a professor of political science at the University of Miami. He specializes in the study of conspiracy theories. Could you get a degree studying conspiracy theories?
It would be neat if you could, but I do teach classes on it. So you can take here at University of Miami probably two or three courses where there'll be a lot of conspiracy theory talk.
Give us some perspective. I assume there have been conspiracy theories throughout history, right?
Oh, all the time. So if you go back in this country, I mean, we started out 400 years ago with people believing that witches were conspiring with Satan against the, right, against the early colonies. And you could fast forward to fears about the British, the French, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, the communists, the capitalists. So we're always pointing fingers at somebody. So the fact that it's happening now is nothing new. But what is different is that we have a president who engages in conspiracy rhetoric quite a bit.
Now, when you say conspiracy rhetoric, do you think it is deliberate, or is it because these conspiracy theorists have decided to define certain words as meaning things that most people don't think of?
So I tend to refer to President Trump as somebody who engages in conspiracy rhetoric rather than call him a conspiracy theorist, because I don't know what's in his head, and I'm not sure anyone does. With Nixon, for instance, he was a conspiracy theorist, and we know because he recorded a lot of his conversations in it, and it sort of makes clear that he believed a lot of groups were out to get us and him.
Yeah.
Whereas Trump, I think he's being more deliberate and strategic by using these theories to motivate his base.
So how, well, give me some examples of what he says that you think is fueling these conspiracy theorists.
One thing that he plays into are conspiracy theories, particularly about foreigners. So when he talked about the caravan recently, he said, well, there's unknown people and, you know, potentially Middle Eastern terrorists in there. There's no evidence that that's the case. But that's something that plays well with core Trump supporters because they're concerned about immigration and tend to have strong conspiracy mindsets. So when we polled people during 2016, during the Republican primaries, the Republicans who supported Trump were those with, you know, most likely to believe in lots of conspiracy theories. And the Republicans who supported other candidates were less likely to believe in conspiracy theories. So Trump's core group of people are conspiracy-minded people. I mean, I don't want to blame Trump for what one person does in terms of committing violent acts. So the line isn't directly clear, and we should not blame Trump directly for it. But what we should blame Trump for is engaging in a lot of conspiracy theories, bringing ideas that aren't necessarily truthy into the mainstream, and for putting ideas out there that are inflammatory and not true. I don't want to blame him for other people's actions. I just want to blame him for his own.
Okay, well, what's the significance of the conspiracy aspect? People tell compelling stories all the time. They make stuff up all the time. But is there something special about this conspiracy aspect?
Conspiracy theories, like you said, I mean, they're narratives. But they're a real, very compelling kind of narrative because you have a dark, shadowy group who's out to get us. Mm-hmm. And us is a sympathetic victim, right? So when you have this dark group, it can inspire us to be angry about it, to want to take action against it. And for people who aren't entirely mentally stable, they can take these ideas and go too far. And a good example of this was Timothy McVeigh. I mean, he believed the government was conspiring against him.
Right.
So he conspired right back.
Well, let me ask you this. As a student of conspiracy theories, have you ever come across one that turned out to be true?
Well, there are ones that turned out to be true. And I think my favorite example of this are two young, cheeky journalists named Woodward and Bernstein who followed a conspiracy theory that turned out to be absolutely true and bigger than they could have imagined.
But are there certain telltale signs that can tell you quickly whether a conspiracy theory is likely to be true or false?
So there are different tests you can do, and I think my favorite one is this. If you're at the point where you have to keep adding more and more and more actors to the conspiracy theory to explain why it hasn't become authoritative knowledge yet, then it's probably not true. You know, I am absolutely certain that conspiracies are taking place right now. But just because that's true doesn't give credence to any particular conspiracy theory. What I tell people is just don't believe every conspiracy theory until it meets a very high level of proof, you know, and it's okay to say, I don't know if that's true. We need to investigate more. And I think that's the best tack to take.
Joe Yusinski teaches political science, University of Miami, and is the co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.